AARP Indiana, an information resource for Hoosiers about the CARE Act, providing support for caregivers when their loved one enters and leaves the hospital. More at action.aarp.org/incarecard.
The challenges to Todd Young's candidacy, a tax hike standoff at the State House, and Dan Coats on the Supreme Court vacancy. That plus the effort to save Carrier, a Colts Hall of Fame weekend, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 19, 2016.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the State Election Commission heard challenges to Todd Young's ballot status in the race for U.S. Senate. Senate Democrats and the Marlon Stutzman campaign filed those challenges, arguing that Young failed to acquire the necessary 500 petition signatures in the 1st Congressional District. As we record this program, the commission is still considering the case. We don't know whether Todd Young will be on the ballot or not. We do know that the Young and Stutzman campaigns have conducted very public fights over the strategy here. Where does the Senate race go from here? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Mike McDaniel, is this something that could split the party?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. It already is splitting the party. I've seen quotes from county chairmen all over Indiana who have taken up basically both sides, more anti than for, about the challenge from Marlon Stutzman on this particular question. But those kind of public statements inside your own party going into the final stages of a campaign is not very positive. You expect the Democrats to try to do this because they don't think they can win with Barron Hill against them. No, they really don't. That's why they assume that's why they made the challenge. And so that's an act that you kind of expect to happen. But when a fellow Republican does that, then you know that this is going to be a divisive campaign, and it's certainly heading that direction.
Well, the Todd Young campaign is all over social media saying that liberals don't want to run against Todd Young.
Liberals want to protect the ballot integrity and to follow the rules, both of which Todd Young did not do, if these allegations are correct. So, you know, I love it when they kick Jim Wallace off the ballot 4 years ago for having fewer mistakes than Todd Young has. But we get a situational ethics when they want Todd Young on the ballot saying, well, we should let him stay on because otherwise it's not fair. I didn't hear the same outcry when Jim Wallace was kicked off and Mike Pence was left on there by himself.
All right, you know what we're going to do? We're going to skip ahead to the next topic at this point, hoping that we'll get a result before this show is over and we can come back to the Senate race. All right, there's a standoff in the General Assembly, and it involves one of the governor's priorities. This battle is Republican versus Republican. House Republicans want increases in the gas tax and the cigarette tax. The governor wants more money for economic development in a plan he calls regional cities. The governor panned the House Republican road plan that contains the tax hikes in his State of the State address. When he pledged to oppose any tax increase, it's now stalled in the state Senate. But the governor's regional cities plan is also stalled in the House, and House Speaker Brian Bosma made it clear this week that the fate of the two proposals is connected.
It would make some sense for those items to proceed together. The regional cities has a similar impact for three communities, and our roads bill, our roads transportation bill, of course, has a strong impact for every community in the state. So that I think that something like that might convince some of our folks to come on board.
you know, he's running for re-election, and whether it's a cigarette tax or not, it sounds to me like he doesn't want that on his resume.
And that's House Minority Leader Scott Peleth suggesting that the governor will let his plan die before he supports a tax hike of any kind. And Delaney, who will win?
Well, you know, I mean, they have supermajorities in both houses, and they have the governor's office, and the governor made it pretty clear what he wanted. I wonder if this is the legislative equivalent of giving the governor the finger, because basically what they're saying is it's this or you don't get your pet project. And frankly, I'd put my money on Brian Bosma on this one.
Seems like he's in control at this point, but it is an unusual tactic.
This is a legislative game of chicken. This is the kind of negotiation you see at the end of a budget session more than you usually do at the end of a short session. But you're going to see $1.5 billion come out eventually for roads. I find it difficult to believe that you want to send legislators home with no money for roads out of this session. And so I believe that you're going to see a hybrid of what the governor wants, some of what's in the House plan. I think the Senate thinks that the local government part of the House plan is very good. And so I think you're going to see a hybrid of the two before it's over, but not with tax increases. The Democrats in the House said they didn't want tax increases. The Senate Republicans and the Senate Democrats said they didn't want tax increases. So you're not going to have a tax increase.
Well, will the governor get his regional cities plan?
In the end, I think probably there will be some sort of solution. But I actually find this in some ways refreshing in that the General Assembly is all about the you know, sort of the topsy-turvy aspect of this. It can be a rough sport. And when you have supermajorities, as you do in both the House and the Senate, and the governor of the same party, there's a tendency perhaps to sort of just roll over or cave to the head of the party, the titular head of the party, the governor. So it's I think that the process is well served by some vigorous debate. And I think there's a point that, you know, Brian Bosma says that when we agreed to regional cities, not the funding aspect, but the concept, it was with two cities. And that was just a year ago.
Right.
So now you're back and you want a 50%
increase
premium in the funding. And that in many minds is problematic.
Yet he's not only challenging the governor, he's doing it in a very public fashion.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where Ann's perspective probably has some relevancy in this. It is a very tough time, and I think Mike's right about this. Does resemble the end of a budget session where you have conference committee and, you know, all of the things that go along with that, where it does get very rough and tumble in the negotiations. So it is very interesting to see, but I think, don't forget, back in December, right after they made the announcement on the regional cities plan, at a public forum, legislative forum, the speaker indicated that he was a little perturbed that he hadn't been notified ahead of time. They had to find out through other means that they had gone with three and they were expecting funding to come. So I think that he's been on record about this for a long time.
You've got both a policy clash and a personality clash here,
clearly,
between Brian Bosma and the governor.
And the other question is the regional cities isn't done, do those leaders in those areas then blame the legislature, the governor, exactly who? You don't ordinarily have this kind of intra-party fight play out in the media the way it is. So it obviously shows that there is animosity there and a real difference of opinion on how this should be funded. And frankly, on Brian Bosma's point, we're going to have to increase the gas tax, okay? We need a long-term solution for roads and streets, and the governor hasn't offered that yet.
But don't you, again, think this is better than everybody just hammering it out behind closed doors and, you know, what the governor
better
says?
It's still going to get hammered out behind closed doors.
Exactly.
Two things. One, there aren't many Democrats to negotiate with left in either house of the legislature. Second,
you don't need them to
second
pass
as far as the taxes are concerned, nobody's going to vote to increase a tax in an election year like this. And the taxes they're talking about in this particular bill are all dwindling. You know, so there's going to be a long-term fix to this problem, but it isn't going to be yet this year. And you're going to have $1.5 billion come out of this year for roads.
But you already
so
do have
saying,
a number
of... get some of what everybody wants, because you're going to have part of the House plan in this at the end of the day, and you're going to have part of the governor's plan and the Senate plan with the $430 million that Brent Hirschman's going to give the local roads in his bill. So you're going to have a hybrid of those three at the end of
so
the day.
So you're saying then that that Brian Bosma's approach to this is wrong?
No,
that
I think
he shouldn't
he,
be
la-
ra- raising
I think
gas taxes.
Bold for trying to offer a long-term solution.
Well, and he can deliver
but
the votes.
When he did a tax increase, that was a non-starter, not only for Democrats.
Never mind.
Now,
you don't need the Democrats to pass
know,
it, Mike.
That is the conventional wisdom. That is the conventional wisdom about not voting for tax increase, certainly in a election year. But you already have a majority of House members on record as voting for it to send it to the
exactly.
Senate.
Exactly.
In the House. So theoretically, if somebody wants to, but if somebody wants to hang them for that, you can already craft the commercial.
And your seats are gerrymandered. Your seats are gerrymandered so much in the Senate that the risk is really not very substantial.
You're going to end up with a hybrid of all three.
All right. Indiana Senator Dan Coats is among those who say President Obama should not appoint a replacement for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Coats argues that the next president should have the pick.
So I think that ought to be put to the American people and let them decide who they want to be their president and who they want to nominate. But at that point, then that person has to be evaluated in a nonpartisan way, in my opinion. Does he have the experience? Does he or she have the criteria to be a justice, the temperament?
All right, John Katzenberger, a question being asked at the State House is, by that logic, should the current vacancy on the Indiana Supreme Court remain open because Mike Pence is up for re-election this year?
You're asking for consistency in the political process, Jim. And we all know that that's not likely. It is an interesting parallel question, but the reality is... It is, Mike.
It is, too.
By a very simple logical progression, it's not apples and dump trucks. It's a very logical conclusion. And I think it's wrong on both cases. I think Governor Pence ought to be able to appoint the next Indiana Supreme Court Justice and President. And they both have. Now, the Senate has an advisory. If they don't like the person who's nominated, then they can reject that nomination.
Okay.
It's very simple.
Right. We should point out Mike Pence hasn't made any public comments with regard to the Scalia vacancy.
He was worried about lightning striking.
Well, but it does raise an important point. Dan Coats, if there is a nomination, should he vote?
I think to me it's pretty simple, actually. If you're in a party, you've been elected to represent your constituency in a governmental body, and an issue comes before you, I think you probably are obliged to represent your constituency, even if you're voting no. I mean, it seems to me that if you, somewhere along the line, we apparently amended the Constitution, and now there's a little footnote or an asterisk that says that instead of a 4-year term, it's really three. And then the last year is just sort of a pretend wind-down, pack-up phase.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as... the Constitution's pretty clear on this, it seems to me.
Yeah. Antonin Scalia was confirmed in an election year, right?
Well, Chuck Schumer, 17 months before the Bush term was up, announced that there would not be anybody except
Bush. He was wrong, too.
Bush.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you, the Democrats, you talk about hypocrisy, and there's hypocrisy. This is the ultimate hypocrisy. And the difference between what's going on there... what's going on in Indiana, Justice Dixon announced that he was retiring last year. The process to replace
the
Scalia
chief,
didn't know when he was going to die.
The process to replace the justice is 2/3 of the way through. They're going to have it down to 10 or 12 people by the end of this show today. Yeah. So this is apples and dump trucks.
But you're saying the president should wait? You're saying the president should wait?
Over. No, I if they want to block him... The president's there. They did it. Democrats did it to Eisenhower. Schumer did it to Bush. Obama himself filibustered against Alito in 2006. You talk about hypocrisy.
Yeah, but you had a vote.
That's ultimate
hypocrisy.
You had
a vote and you had a committee hearing. The difference is that's a distinction in the state and federal without a difference.
Yeah.
What you have here is the Republicans have filibustered and stopped. We have had fewer district court and appellate court appointments for the fewest number since the 1950s, okay? They have prevented Barack Obama, who the vitriol You know, and it has to be, at least in part, because they cannot recognize the fact that we have an African American as president. And that goes on. That goes on. And in terms of Senator Coates, all he has done for the 6 years he's been there is pad his retirement account.
He's not even done anything. There is a way that the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate can adhere to the Constitution and apparently its own conscience, and that is have a hearing and vote.
Which
and
is what I think
because there's actually established.
I think that's what they'll do.
Right.
McConnell said he would.
And that's more politically expedient, too, than being appearing to be obstructionist.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the next president get to choose a replacement for Justice Scalia? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, is Eric Holcomb a good choice for lieutenant governor? 23% said yes, 55% said no. 22% said, I liked it better when he appeared on Indiana Week in Review. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Politicians at every level are trying to keep Carrier from closing its Indianapolis factory and moving 1,400 jobs to Mexico. Meanwhile, union leaders are trying to convince Carrier to stay, but it's a long shot. Congressman Andre Carson says he'll fight to create laws that penalize companies for moving jobs outside the U.S.
They build their institutions off the backs of hardworking Americans, and when they see an opportunity, they move overseas. It has to stop.
Even Donald Trump was bashing Carrier this week for planning the move. John Schwanis, will any of this make a difference?
Other than making it very uncomfortable for Carrier and its parent company, probably not. I think this, when you have a large corporation that's made these kinds of decisions and has to answer to investors and so forth, it's probably too tough to reverse course. But what I think this could do is heighten sensitivity to the issue and maybe think about it. It's brought Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump together effectively, and that it takes something pretty rare to do that.
Brought Republicans and Democrats together.
And I do think that because of this and the attention this is getting, it may help protect other jobs in the future, manufacturing jobs in the Midwest and throughout the country in whatever manner is chosen. But I don't know if it would reverse this particular case.
Carrier's planning to pay $3 an hour for labor in Mexico. That's tough to compete
versus
against.
Versus $23 an hour.
Well, it is tough to compete against on a bottom line basis, but you have to look at this on a broader scale. And unless Carrier intends to reduce the price of its product by a similar amount, then you wonder where the difference is being made. And that's where the point that John made about investors comes in. I think that over the last 30 years or so, management's alignment for its compensation has been aligned with investors. And so it's natural that they're going to make decisions that favor investors over other things, such as your workforce. If you can reduce your cost of operations by $20 an hour per person, and that money goes to the bottom line, which then you are benefiting from as the executive in this firm, you're going to make that decision. I think we're on the cusp, actually, because the video of this whole announcement has gone viral, and it's very difficult to watch when you know that 1,400 people are losing their livelihood and their families and the community is being affected like this. I think we're on the cusp of a time now where you're going to see some of the shift from complete adherence to shareholder value and more about a community value. Because if you don't have it happen naturally, you're going to have it happen by force, because you can see the activism that's coming and you see the alliances that are being made by this announcement. We're on the cusp of big change.
And this is the sort of thing that should likely hurt Carrier sales.
Oh, I would think it would hurt Carrier sales. But don't you think tax policy also figures in this?
Absolutely.
And it's about time for Congress to step up and change the policy which makes it advantageous to make these kinds of moves. And that's something the Republicans have not been willing to touch. I think maybe now with all this pressure and with Trump's statement, maybe they'll look at that issue again, because we're facilitating exactly that kind of policy by our tax policy.
Is Carrier a bad corporate citizen?
I think they're, as John said, they're making a decision that is a global economy now, and they're doing what they think they have to do, which I think is, in the long term, is a mistake for them, as John also pointed out. But as far as, I agree that there's tax policy involved here, but remember, the free trade agreement was championed by Bill Clinton, has been championed by Republicans also along the way, and I think that comes into play. And I think the way they did this, tapped into real anger in the public about the way they announced to the people that they're going to lose these jobs. And it has brought Republicans and Democrats together to try to deal with this, but I'm not so sure in this day and age how you penalize a company for doing that based on the free trade policies that we have in place in this government.
You change the tax policy.
They have to change them. There's no question about that.
And then they can sell all of their units in South America.
It started with the free trade agreement.
All right. Well, it also is started by the policy that makes it advantageous to do this, and that has to change.
All right, thousands of new jobs could be coming to the west side of Indianapolis. The Indianapolis Airport Authority announced a development plan this week on 400 acres of land near the old airport terminal. Athletes Business Network says it could build a medical complex that would focus on brain injuries. It's a complex that may someday include a 20,000-seat stadium. Airport Director Mario Rodriguez says the goal is to help the local economy.
It's been the vision of the board and the vision of the staff to improve the economic conditions around the airport. And believe it or not, this is one of the few airports that actually is putting airport land back into productive use.
Now, since that announcement was made, a vote by the Airport Authority Board has been delayed because of questions about the financing here. Will this project come about?
I don't know. I mean, the financing, obviously the IBJ, Indianapolis Business Journal, brought up some real concerns about that, and you've had a change in administration, and the new administration wants to look at this and make sure that it's feasible. I mean, the concept sounds terrific, but we need to make sure it's on good, sound financial footing before we go ahead with it.
We previously talked about one of the other proposals for using this land, which involved a casino. That was rejected, obviously. If this plan goes away, is the casino still a possibility?
Well, I never thought the casino was a real possibility there. If they're going to do something like that, it would be more likely it would be downtown in conjunction with a convention facility. I mean, that's the only way I think that you'd ever see that happen. I'm not sure you ever will see it happen in downtown Indianapolis. But this one, the reason they gave for this one over the casino was because they felt that it involved more people in their daily lives. So, as Ann said, you know, if they came to the door with their financing in place, I think this would give everybody a lot more comfort. But at least at this point, there are a lot of questions to be answered before we can move forward on anything at the airport.
Well, they asked for proposals last year. Had talked about having a decision by the end of the year. We're already to the end of February. It seems like maybe this should have been worked out a little better by this point, doesn't it?
I don't know. I guess if ideally, sure, you'd like to be able to say that you had all your T's crossed and your I's dotted. But, I mean, this is the market at work. I mean, is there demand for this land at this time? And if so, for what purpose? And I think the absence of a greater flurry of proposals and the vetting that would accompany those proposals is probably indication that this is not there's not an appetite for that land for any use at this point. That's not to say there wouldn't be in the future. So it's just, I mean, you can't fabricate, create an interest that isn't
there.
It's
a great parcel of land.
Yeah. Right. But this proposal from Athletes Business Network seemed to be a little pie in the sky.
Well, there were certain aspects of it that raised very red flags. The Indianapolis Business Journal mentioned several of them, but, you know, this 20,000-seat arena that they're talking about here, the idea and the proposal was that maybe they would have NCAA Final Four games there.
And
that's just ridiculous when you consider they're having 70,000 people at the stadium downtown. Right. So there's reason to be concerned, but I think John's point is well made. That land is very valuable. That land is prime for the right development. This may ultimately be it, but there are lots of things that need to be worked out ahead of time. It's better to wait for the right thing than it is to put the wrong thing in there and foreclose future development.
All right. The Indianapolis Colts will play the Packers in the Hall of Fame game in August. It's the same weekend that the Hall inducts its newest class, and that class includes Tony Dungy. Here's the moment when the former Colts coach found out he'd been chosen.
Coach, there's a knock on the door.
It is my great pleasure. God bless you, coach. God bless you.
Mike McDaniel, how will that weekend in August rank for Colts fans?
It's going to be tremendous. Marvin Harrison, Tony Dungy, the Colts playing the Packers. It's going to be a tremendous start of the season. And then they go to London and play during the regular season. It's going to be a great year for the Colts fan.
The Dungy era in Indianapolis will long be remembered, not only for a Super Bowl win, but for a lot of really good teams.
Oh, yeah, a lot of really good teams. And the contribution that the Colts and Tony Dungy and Peyton Manning made to the community, it's priceless. So it's good that it's being remembered.
There will be more players from those teams that Tony Dungy led go into the Hall of Fame in future years.
That would be great.
I think that's right. Okay, at this point, we're running out of program here. Still no word from the State Government Center. There has not been a vote yet on the challenges to Todd Young's ballot status. That's going to be our lead story next week. In the meantime,
talk about a cliffhanger.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.